From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. It has been well over a year since the deadliest fire ever in California history razed to the ground the town of Paradise. Thousands of people lost their homes, and more than 80 people lost their lives in the flames that began to burn on November 8, 2018, in a retirement community in Butte County. Now, a new book by two reporters who covered the fire for the Guardian newspaper from the start have told the story of that devastating fire through interviews with hundreds of people. One of them is my guest, Dani Anguiano. She's a writer for The Guardian and was formerly a reporter for the Chico Enterprise Record, where she covered Butte County, including Chico and Paradise. And she co-authored with Alistair G the new book, Fire in Paradise, An American Tragedy. Welcome to the program, Dani.
Hi, Sonali. Thank you. I'm really glad to be here.
So fire in California is a very common occurrence. It's something we expect every year. Some would say it's a natural part of the terrain of the state. But was the fire in Paradise natural?
No, I think, as you said, fire in California is normal. It's a part of the landscape. The landscape has actually evolved with fire. There are some, plants that rely on fire. But what happened in Paradise was not normal. It was not the average fire that we see here. The fire that started the morning of November 8th quickly grew, driven by the wind, and almost immediately was unusual because it actually moved faster than fire scientists knew was possible, and it headed straight for this town of 27,000 people, Paradise.
And the sense that we got when everything was said and done, when the clearing was taking place, when the bodies were being pulled out, was that there was only one way in and out of this community, and that people seemed to have gotten caught unawares. The fire was just too fast for them to respond. But in fact, they were better prepared than I think the public realized, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. The fire came to Paradise so quickly that people had very little time to escape. And what happened was once they knew the fire was there, they got onto the few main roads out of town. Paradise is located in the Sierra Nevada foothills. It's about 15-minute drive from the valley. And so people poured onto these roads. But as you said, Paradise was actually better prepared. It had an escape plan. It had staged evacuation drills. It had a reverse 911 system. The problem is when tens of thousands of people get on the road all at the same time, you're going to have gridlock. There's no town in America that could withstand that without creating massive gridlock. And that's what we saw in Paradise, with tens of thousands of people on the roads, which were quickly being overrun with fire and, things burning on all sides of them.
What sort of community was Paradise? We hear that it was a retirement community, but give me a little bit more of the history and demographics of this community.
Sure. To go back, it was originally, occupied by Indigenous people. And then around the Gold Rush, settlers arrived hoping to strike it rich in Paradise. And out of that, this town developed. And it was, came to be a small suburban American town. It's not the California of Los Angeles or San Francisco. This is a more rural agricultural area. And it was a small, tight-knit community. Unlike a lot of California, what made Paradise unique was that it was very affordable. It was a place where a young family could buy a home and also where people could come to retire. And I think that's why it had a higher population of senior citizens and disabled people.
You can't tell the story of the Paradise Fire without bringing up PG&E, Pacific Gas and Electric, the utilities company that was eventually, after lengthy legal battles, found to be responsible for the initial for this fire, in fact, initiating. So give us, for those people who weren't paying attention or maybe forgot, what PG&E's role in all of this was.
Sure. So PG&E is the power provider up here. And what happened was, on the morning of November 8th, a transmission line, a tower on that line, malfunctioned. It was a tower that was incredibly old. It was nearly 100 years old. It was, decades past what the company deemed its, useful life. And so this worn piece of equipment broke, and it sparked this massive fire that would just completely destroy the town of Paradise. And PG&E was suspected pretty early on, because the fire again started under that tower. And their culpability was established within, I believe, about 6 months of the fire. And then just a few months ago, they pled guilty to 84 counts of involuntary manslaughter for their role in it.
Who did you speak with when you put this book together? Obviously, it was based on the reporting that you and your colleague Alistair G did for the Guardian newspaper. But we know that there were, of course, instantly tens of thousands of essentially refugees from this fire, many of whom fled to neighboring Chico. Did you talk to those people who once called Paradise their home?
Yeah, well, actually, when the fire began, I grew up kind of near Paradise and have some family there. So the very first people I talked to were my own family members who lived and worked in Paradise. And once I was actually sent to cover the fire, the first place I went was an evacuation center, and then to this Walmart in Chico that essentially became a refugee camp. It's where, thousands of people, as they fled Paradise, they fled into this neighboring town called Chico, and many of them went to this Walmart, where, a lot of them were sleeping outside or in their cars. And they told me stories of how they escaped this just impossibly fast moving fire. One man, Andrew, told me about how, he'd had some firefighting experience, and he thought he was going to stay and try to save his mom's home. And so that's what he did. When his elderly mother left, he stayed armed with a hose and thought he would at least be able to protect her home from the flames. And, that didn't happen. The fire came so fast, his hose ran out of water. And pretty soon he found himself confronted with this wall of flames, and almost nothing to defend himself except for to run into the street and hope to avoid the fire.
So where is the town of Paradise at right now, in terms of reviving this community, in terms of the kind of aid that the community got? I mean, this was a multi-billion dollar tragedy, even just setting aside the 85 lives that were lost, the homes and people's livelihoods that were lost. There was a huge cost of mitigating the disaster. Where is it right now?
So Paradise looks a lot different than it did, about a year and a half ago. That fire, as you said, destroyed thousands of buildings. It destroyed, I believe about 18,000 buildings, about 90% of the homes in the town. And so immediately after the fire, it essentially was just piles of rubble. It was burned out cars stuck on the road. And from there, the town has made great progress in clearing that area out. Thanks to some support from the state and federal governments, they've been able to get rid of all this toxic rubble from the fire. And people are starting to return. It's about 15% of what it was pre-fire. So just a few thousand people whose homes happen to survive, or people who are still building their homes. But the people who live there today have accepted that it's going to be a very different kind of town, that it'll be a much smaller town, and that a lot of that history that they loved isn't so easily accessible anymore.
What sort of trauma did the survivors and have the survivors of the Paradise Fire gone through? I mean, I can't imagine that it would be easy to document that in words, but you spoke with a lot of the survivors who, have not been able to go back to normal, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think for so many of these people, their lives were just so interrupted that day with the loss of their town and their home. I know some people never returned. They never went back after the fire. In terms of trauma, it's tremendous. It's almost beyond imagination. One woman I spoke with, Sky, the morning of the fire, her elderly father woke her up. He was a former volunteer firefighter. He woke her up and he told her that she should go because there was a fire coming. but that he was going to stay and try to save the neighborhood, basically save some of these historic buildings, which is what he did. He helped neighbors save their homes, and he helped firefighters in their battle to try to, you know, keep an eye on the fire. And when Sky left that day, you know, she couldn't get back a hold of her father. Ultimately, you know, her father perished in the fire, as did the historic home that her family had lived in for nearly a century, and as did her town. It's a loss that I think is almost without precedent, you know, not just to lose one's loved one or one's home, but one's entire town. And I think it's something people are still really, really trying to work through and trying to get their lives to some semblance of normalcy.
What is the price that PG&E will pay for what happened, you know, that they were found guilty of and liable for?
We're still kind of seeing that play out. I mean, so far, PG&E has, you know, agreed to a settlement with the town of Paradise and with some of the other government entities there for about, I believe, $500 million. They've also come to an agreement with the victims of the fire to settle for, I believe it's about $12 or $13 billion, and they're still kind of finalizing those details. I think, you know, the other question is, in addition to what they're paying financially, is how will they change? You know, what will they do to prevent this from happening again? And I think, you know, right now it's not clear. They're taking some new steps, but we're all kind of waiting to see, you know, what's going to happen. Are they going to have the cultural shift that they need to stop causing these disasters?
The government, the state government of California, what responsibility did it bear for allowing PG&E to do what it did and for tackling the crisis, you know, in terms of providing support to the survivors?
Yeah, I know for a lot of survivors, you know, they've gotten some help, but I think a lot of people still feel kind of abandoned. They feel like the world has moved on from their tragedy and they still need support. So that's, you know, that's ongoing. And as for PG&E, there are a lot of conversations about what role the state needs to play in regulating them effectively so this doesn't happen again. And so, you know, I know there have been some changes around the regulation and what PG&E has to do with its lines, you know, in terms of vegetation clearance and that sort of thing. And I know the governor has taken a pretty strong approach, telling the company it needs to change earlier this year. He nearly rejected their bankruptcy deal if they didn't go back and make some more changes.
We know that PG&E was responsible for triggering the fire, but in general, over the past few years, fires in California have gotten more common, more intense, and are not relegated to a particular part of the year anymore, it seems. It used to be a fire season, and now, I mean, the Paradise fire may have been sparked by a downed power line, but the conditions were ripe for that fire to spread, and it happened in November, so late in the year. Are we to expect more fires like the Paradise fire?
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, as you said, PG&E's power line failed. It was a tower that needed to be replaced. It failed and caused this fire, but I think the climate crisis ultimately set the stage for this. These hotter, drier conditions, they make it more likely that we'll see these increasingly destructive and devastating fires. And one of, I think, the big takeaways from our book that we've heard from fire scientists is that we need to look at what happened in Paradise. We need to remember it, because all the evidence points to us to continue to have these shockingly destructive fires. You know, what happened in Paradise will most likely happen again.
And the way in which we are approaching our, you know, this all year round fire season, I mean, the state of California is more forward thinking on issues of climate change, which is, of course, what's causing these hotter, drier conditions. But still, it's only one state out of a nation of 50 states. And climate change is one of those things that mitigation efforts can be local, but the impacts are always global. You don't have a hermetic seal between one state and the next when it comes to the atmosphere. Is California doing enough? And, you know, we know the answer to the fact that the nation isn't doing enough, but is California by itself doing enough on climate change?
Well, I think one of the things I've heard, you know, from many people we talk to is there's just always more to be done. There's always things we could be doing better. And I think that's perhaps one of the silver linings that's come out of this is that, you know, after what happened in Paradise, we've seen that the destruction of an entire town and the loss of so many dozens of lives is possible. And so from what we've heard, you know, people realize that this could happen to them. And I think it's causing, you know, towns and perhaps states to rethink how they approach this and how they prepare.
Another aspect of this story is just housing as well, right? I mean, people moved to Paradise because housing costs in neighboring areas were too high. When they became refugees, they were left with nothing in areas where they still couldn't afford housing. Housing is another huge problem that California faces. And of course, during this time of lockdown with the coronavirus, people losing jobs, being less and less able to pay rent, it's becoming an even bigger problem. How important is housing an aspect of the story that you write in your book, Fire in Paradise?
I mean, housing is absolutely essential. As we've talked about, in addition to just the natural beauty that drew people to this area, housing was a huge factor. And, you know, I think that part of Northern California generally has more affordable housing than the rest of the state, but Paradise especially. You know, we just have heard countless stories of people who were disabled and unable to work, and this is the one place that they could live. So I think it's such an important part of the conversation, because what we saw after this fire was people asking, you know, well, should Paradise even rebuild? And I think it's almost the wrong question, because it ignores all the factors that push people to live there in the first place. And for many people, it's that, you know, there isn't anywhere else to live.
And the other aspect of it, going back to PG&E that we were talking about, is that in the past year or so, there's been a lot of conversation around a state takeover of utilities companies, reorganizing how power is generated and delivered. And there have been many different ideas. Some of them have actually been taken quite seriously, even by some local officials, including some mayors in California. I believe it was the San Jose mayor who had some very important ideas. Should the Paradise fire, or do you think, I should say, that the Paradise Fire in particular will mark PG&E's death knell?
You know, it's a tricky question. We'll see. You know, I think everyone in Paradise is hoping that the world, the state will remember them, and that will be an impetus to change PG&E. It's a really complicated question about, does the state want to be in the business of providing energy? PG&E is just such a massive organization, you know, 100,000 miles of lines. And, you know, one person we talked to described this theory of complexity, that some organizations become so big that almost no one understands them. And I think the people closest to understanding them are probably at PG&E. So it's a question to the state of what kind of work do they want to take on to prevent these disasters from happening again.
And then you also have the federal government. I mean, this happened in November 2018, so during the Trump administration. Often when you have such disastrous events, I mean, this was the deadliest fire in California's recorded history and the deadliest fire in the United States in about 100 years. Ordinarily, the federal government would come in with federal emergency declarations and aid. How do you assess the federal government's response?
You know, I think I remember during one of the meetings, a community meeting a few days after the fire had started, that, you know, the president was going to declare this emergency declaration. Things seem to eventually happen. I think what was difficult about the response was not so much necessarily the financial aspects of it right away. It was, you know, the emotional response from the president. I think it really hurt a lot of people that before providing condolences to the dozens of victims, you know, to the families who'd lost loved ones, that the first comment he made about it was about forest management. And that was something that I think hurt a lot of fire survivors, even some of whom were, you know, big supporters of his.
Right. I mean, Trump fancies himself an expert in all sorts of arenas. He is currently a virologist and in November 2018 was a forest management expert, doling out advice on Twitter to the governor of California and other state level officials. Well, I want to thank you so much, Danny, for joining us today. Is there a website for the book?
Yeah, you can go to fireinparadisebook.com for more information about the book and where it can be purchased.
We'll post a link to that from our website later as well. Thank you so much, Danny. Good luck to you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
My guest has been Danny Anguiano, writer for The Guardian, who covered the Paradise Fire. She was formerly a reporter for the Chico Enterprise Record, where she covered Butte County, including Chico and Paradise. And we've been discussing the new book she co-authored with her colleague at The Guardian, Alistair G. It's called Fire in Paradise, an American Tragedy. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.